Yes. Okay. All right. Tonight, we are the title called The Challah Crisis, an exploration of daily dilemmas in Jewish business law. So I'm going to share a screen because Suzanne could see the sheet. Daphne Brackett. That. Okay. All right. So basically, we've been focused on a couple of classes about the Ten Commandments. And the other Ten Commandments, we just had Shulis. We talked about that. Hope your Shulis was awesome. I hope you were able to find a little cheesecake in the situation. Perhaps it was a cheesecake.
Hi. Shulis was awesome.
Shulis was awesome here? Nice. That's awesome. So let's talk. But then at Har Sinai, just to give you the timeline, according to there's a debate about that, but just keeping it simple, let's take the pshat, based off the Ramban, Nachmanides. Shavuos morning, the Jewish people heard the Ten Commandments from the voice of God. They had a prophecy. So there's a debate. Did they hear a prophet? They had themselves were elevated to a prophetic level, or did God create a voice to sort of simulcast, you know, like you have a speaker? You are now listening in to Moshe's prophecy. And then he went and then he received the Mishpatim, the civil law, which is chapters 21, 22, and 23. Of the Parsha of Mishpatim, and then he writes it down, and then he tells them the next day. That's what we call it, the second day of Shavuos, seventh day of Sivan, and they hear that. Then they offer up some offerings, which is the last step of their conversion. By the way, those people do not know that conversion is learned from the journey of the Jews. The Jews did circumcision; the men did at Egypt. Before they received the Torah, they went to the mikvah. Then they had an offering, which every convert ultimately, when the mikvah thing, has to bring an offering. And lastly was, they had the acceptance of the mitzvot. They said, na'asev and ishma. Then they became halakhically Jews. So all Jews are, in a certain sense, there was a conversion. They were entered into the covenant at the same time. In a certain sense, now you can say, they were certainly the Jewish people on some sense, but there was a completely transformation, because if that was not needed, then they wouldn't have to go through a conversion process. Okay, that's the basic thing.
What's the expiring day? Is there also an offering?
We can't do it. There's no temple.
Right.
But the obligation.
Is there a substitute?
Not. So it will be at the time when the Mikdash is rebuilt, there will be an obligation on every convert to bring an offering. It's still owed. Now it allows them, once they bring the offering, then gives them access to the sacrificial foods. So until they provide that, then they couldn't have the Korban Pesach. There's no, so that completes, in a certain, that completes their conversion. But there's no difference, because we don't have that whole component of Judaism right now. That's a little bit of a technical aside. Obviously, that's why we read the Megillat Ruth, where she is the quintessential convert on Har Sinai, because the Jews converted as well. The book of Seiros HaDibros is introduced by the character of Yitro, not a Jew. He was the ultimate person who could receive the Torah, a person who was personally interested. Okay. All right, so let's go in. We're going to now read. Okay, so we're going to read. All right, so Suzanne, since we can all hear you through the TV, as you know, could you read this text? Okay. Shmo Rab about the Mishpatim. Can you read it out there? You're on mute still, so that'll be hard. There you go.
What is it, Rabbi?
Hold on one second. Let me get the volume right. Hold on 1 second. We don't have the volume right. Yeah, Suzanne, yeah, read it out.
Okay, Rabbi Judah the Prince, editor of.
Hold on one second. I realize that. Hold on 1 second. My bad over here. I got to. One second. The old not doing it on the right. When will I learn? When will I learn? That one. Try again.
I don't see.
Yeah, but you don't. Okay, but I was just testing the. Okay. All right. Now you're good. Take it again.
Okay, Rabbi Yehuda, the prince, editor of the Mishnah, said, just as the Holy One, blessed be He, warned the Jewish people about observing the Ten Commandments, so too did He warn them concerning the civil and monetary law. Why? Because the whole world is dependent on it. As the verse in Proverbs states, the king by justice establishes the land.
Okay, excellent. So the Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, the author of the Mishnah, writes, welcome, Matt. Welcome. That just as he warned the Jewish people about observing the Ten Commandments, he also warned them concerning all the civil law. Why? Because the entire world is dependent upon it. Okay. So the question is what you see on question number one. But if the civil law is so important, then why didn't it come before the Ten Commandments? They had to deal with the Ten Commandments first, and then sequencing as, imagine God functioning as a teacher. He gives them the Ten Commandments, then he gives them the civil law. But then Rabbi Yehuda Nasi says, right, Judah the Prince says, oh, why is the Ten Commandments, why is the Mishpatim, the civil law next? The whole world depends upon it. Oh, so if the whole world depends upon it, then let it come first. If it's so important, it should be prior to the Aseret Dibros. So why, in fact, is the Dibros first? And if you were here for previous classes, you probably know the answer. No pressure. What do you say, guys?
I think the Ten Commandments are overarching.
Okay, good.
Like, that everything kind of comes afterwards. You know, often parents kind of deal with everyone.
So, what's the first dip? What's the first commandment? I'm the Lord your God, which is a mitzvah of believing or maintaining, knowing God is, and then the prohibition of idolatry. And then swearing falsely in His name, and then is the the commandment to observe Shabbos. So basically, that's the foundation. In other words, if the essence of Judaism is God, if you don't have God, if you have civil society, every society has civil law. Europe. Highly secular, the EU very much has a lot of, they have civil law. So you can have a civil law without God. That's the European Union. They have official, they have the official church, but essentially it's largely not really having much of an impact on their society right now. So, but here we're doing the Dibros as a function of God's vision for the Jewish people. In other words, every society needs to have a lawful conduct, or else you'll have no society. Okay. But the whole idea of the insight of the moment of revelation is that civil law is a function of a God vision, a godly worldview. Okay, so therefore it's not separated out, not just even civil law is not secular. We don't have secular law. Even the prohibition of you shall not murder or you should not steal, which exists in every single system, it's not a civil law. You know, we call it civil law, but it's not civil in the same sense. You're doing it fundamentally. God commanded it because it is a truly just thing to do, not to steal and murder. But it's emerging from God's vision for humanity. You know what I'm saying? That's a very big difference versus what we call social contract. If you guys learned about Locke and John and Hobbes and Hume and all the philosophers the continental philosophers of the 16th and 17th century, basically they. So what is it? Who can tell me what social contract is? Social contract theory of law. For basically, in order to have a society, we all have to, in order, we can't, We cannot do things that all, basically people say, as long as there's an expression of that is everything's permitted as long as it doesn't hurt anybody. So basically we will do, in other words, why am I not stealing? Because I can't have a society for that. In other words, I agree not to steal from you. You agree to steal not from me. And we can live, have a mutual coexistence. It's not saying there's any intrinsically moral lack in stealing. Judah says that it's true that if you have theft, you will not have a society, but it's a foundational lack in your soul that you're a person's a thief. I'm saying it's a moral flaw, not just lack of having a just society. It goes beyond that. It makes an additional claim. Okay, so that's why the Dibros are giving the overarching frame, and as you may have heard, that all the 613 commandments are actually could be nestled within the 10 categories. We did a little bit of that last time, and that's why you have to have these civil laws. Okay, what I want to do is I want to get down to I'm going to do number three. As a person becomes more committed to their Judaism, what should they stress or try to balance? The ritualistic mitzvahs, Shabbat, Kashrut, Tefillah, or the monetary laws? What do you say? But most people say, oh, this person is becoming a Baal Tshuva. What is their first association? Shabbat, number two? Kashrut? Tefillah, all right. All the ritual mitzvahs. Now, what made them observant? That they're now ritually, they are from a ritual perspective, they're more compliant with Orthodox Judaism. But what we've learned here, that should not be the only list. They might keep kosher, but they're also careful in their financial dealings. When there is a dispute, how do they navigate? Do they navigate it based upon a Jewish law, or what happens in the business world is the law of the jungle, and whatever you can get away with, you get away with. But when I come to shul, I'm a good Jew. When I sit down in the kitchen, I'm a good Jew. Okay? Even if I go into the bedroom, I'm a good Jew. But what comes in the business world, I'm an animal. Do whatever I want. Whatever I can grab off the table, you know, that's it. So we clearly see that we just read Rabbi Judah the Prince, the author of the Mishnah, pointed out that it's a foundation, the civil law. What did God told Moshe to bring to the mitzvahs, but they didn't sequence more ritual law after the Ten Commandments. A few things here and there, mostly civil law, damages. What are the obligations of a person watching property, paid, unpaid? Okay, in other words, how you should conduct yourself in a lawful manner. All right, so that's something which is that's why I feel I have responsibility is to go through some basic cases, Jewish law, or in America, who has to be concerned about law? I mean, everyone, but who studies law in America? Lawyers. In Judaism, no, everybody has to study law because you want to be a lawful person. Why do I think that? Oh, I have to ask 16,000 questions about mistakes in the kitchen. But what about mistakes about my taxes or how I treat with the employee or the employer or making claims about damages or not? Why is that not as that is equally as a critical, one could argue, perhaps even more critical than the ritual mitzvahs? There's the two sides of the tablets. Tablet one is between you and God. Tablet two, between you and man. They didn't have one tablet. They got both tablets. You got to do your best in both categories. So what I'm trying to share here, we're going to go through three cases. We're not going to look at proposed answer. We're going to read it out. And I want to see what I'm going to, and we're going to go around. I did this a little bit last year, but these are fresh cases. So see what you guys say. And then we'll see what the Dayan, the judge, which is an expert in Jewish business law, had to say about the thing, and we will say who was the most close to the right answer. Okay, all right, ready? Let's do it. The Challah crisis, stage one. All right, Suzanne, you're the reader because everybody can hear you.
Mrs. Horowitz was known throughout her neighborhood for her culinary talents. Her home-baked challah was acclaimed by all who tasted it. Every week on Thursday, Mrs. Horowitz would bake about 50 challahs, which she sold to her friends as an additional source of income. One Thursday afternoon, as Mrs. Horowitz prepared the last batch, her Bosch mixer stopped working. I'm glad it lasted a day. Mrs. Horowitz exclaimed to her husband, at least I have the Hollis for this week. I'll have to have it fixed before next week. On Friday, Mrs. Horowitz brought the mixer into the appliance repair store. How long will it take to fix? Mrs. Horowitz inquired. 2 to 3 days, replied the repairman. But of course, we're closed tomorrow and Sunday. I'll check it today and have it repaired by Wednesday. That's okay, said Mrs. Horowitz, but I must have it back by Thursday morning. I have orders for 50 challahs to bake them. I don't foresee a problem with that, said the repairman. On Wednesday afternoon, Mrs. Horowitz called the appliance repair store. I brought my Bosch mixer in for repair last Friday, she said. Is it ready? I'm sorry, replied the repairman. It needs a replacement part, but I didn't order it yet. I can get the piece tomorrow evening and have the mixer ready by Friday afternoon. What? Exclaimed Mrs. Horowitz. Friday afternoon won't do. At this point, there's nothing I can do, replied the repairman. I can't get the piece until tomorrow evening, even with express delivery. I'll have to cancel the challah orders then, said Mrs. Horowitz. That's a few $100 of loss for me. I think that should be deducted from the repair charge. Ask Rav, said the repairman. Mrs. Horowitz called Rabbi Diane and asked, is the appliance repairman liable for the lost revenue due to his negligence away?
All right, stop right there. Okay. So basically, all right, so 1 second. All right, let's, what did you just say? Daphne, I didn't hear what you said, Daphne.
Absolutely not. No, he said.
Okay, all right. Hold on.
I have to say on this. I have a lot to
say. Okay. Hold on. All right. Everybody. Okay. Good. We're gonna take it slow. All right, Daphne. As a lawyer, you got to weigh it first. But don't look ahead. So this guy, the repairman, promised Mrs. Horowitz that she will have her Bosch mixer, which, by the way, is the best mixer. FYI.
Hold on.
Oh, this is the next level. All right, whatever. For those who are, all right, this is a separate conversation. We're not going to that. Yeah, but she's got the hook. Okay, whatever.
He did not promise.
So one second. He said, let's go back to what he said.
I do not foresee a problem. It is not a problem.
He said to her, 2 or 3 days, but of course we're close. I'll check today and have it repaired by Wednesday. That's okay, he says. I must have back by Thursday morning. I have over 50 orders to bake. In other words, she was very explicit to the guy that I need it back because there are 50 households that are dependent on me producing my world-famous challahs. You know,
which little... he replied, I do not foresee a problem with that.
So he said,
Rabbi, can you think of public policy? Would anyone repair any device if they could be liable for lost revenue? It's like if you cause an accident on the highway and people are late for work and they miss an hour of work and you get paid $20 an hour, but this guy gets paid $400 an hour. So if you cause an accident on the highway causing, I don't know, 1,000 people to lose an hour of work, are you liable for their lost wages? It's not right to make this person as a repairman, a small business owner, liable for lost revenue for circumstances that may not be within his control.
If you're saying, one could argue, if you're saying working in a good faith, in other words, let's say he said, you know, as soon as you left, I called in and the Bosch people said it's going to take 2 weeks for the order, you know, to get the part. Everybody would agree he's not responsible. He does not control the thing. But it seems that he was a little bit negligent over here.
I don't know if it's negligence. What if he repaired this and 99 out of 100 times it went this way, but for some reason this time it didn't go that way? So he's liable for hundreds of dollars. What if that's his whole week of revenue as well?
What's
he's
that?
Also a small business owner.
Hold on.
And there's nothing here to indicate that he didn't have a good faith basis for his assurances. And he said,
okay. Hold on. It says it needs a replacement part, but I didn't order it yet. What kind of pathetic response is that? You know the lady needs to by Wednesday night. So why didn't you call her immediately? Like, I, you know, why? What's going on here? This is not. This is. this is acceptable. This is, she totally messed this lady over.
I don't think it's so much him as it is her. I don't think she has a reasonable basis to rely on this repairman's word either, because so many things happen that you can't take into account. What if he did order it and it was lost?
They didn't say that.
It's too close.
Okay. All right. So, okay. Daphne, you're very clear about where you hold. So you basically hold she has no claim of getting any of that money. Let's say for the $50, let's say she got $5 a challah, so it's $250, $300 for a challah. She has no claim on this guy.
That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying they're both a little bit right and they're both a little bit wrong. As in any litigation,
no party is
100% right or wrong. If every repairman was liable for lost revenue like this, it would be unjust. I mean, there's no perfect justice.
I'm not asking about all. You're giving me a lawyer answer. You're not giving me a straight answer. Let's say it's a $300 loss. Does Mrs. Horowitz have a claim on the repairman? Yes, okay, no, or partial?
I mean, everyone has a claim and anyone can sue, but is it a good claim and will she win? It should be. That's the question.
Okay. All right.
Everyone has a claim. I have 1,000 claims. Does it mean anything?
All right. So this is okay. All right. So we. All right. So we will explore. Okay. I want to hear from Stephanie. What do you? What says you?
She said.
So if he had said, "I guarantee it'll be done by Wednesday, Thursday, whatever it is," then I feel like it's a different situation, because obviously this park thing was foreseen that it would need a park. But he also might have hurt himself, because I'm not really sure why he would tell her he didn't order the part yet, because that gives her a stronger claim than if it there were unforeseen circumstances, it won't be ready till Friday afternoon. Then, who knows?
But he's being an honest guy. He got distracted and he knew he had to order the part.
I think he should give her a discount. I don't know that it has to be.
Oh, so you go for a discount. All right, so you go. You know that he's got. So let's say the repair is $300. Her loss is $300. Make it very simple. She should get some money off, not the whole thing. Okay, $50.
Hold on.
I'm just getting, there are other people in the class, people who actually decided to come in person. So we're going to give them at least an equal chance to say something. Okay. Touché. All right. Jamie. Okay. Just say you want to, what's your point? What is your point?
Have it done precisely by.
Correct. There's no guarantee. Okay.
He did not do the things he was supposed to do. If he was closed Saturday, Sunday, fine, but Monday morning, he should have called for the park. So by not calling for the park, literally till the night before she needed it,
right?
I feel like that was a negligence on his part. And because he employed him, there's probably many different repairmen. She probably had her choice of repairmen. He told her it would be there by Wednesday. And so she probably may have chose his services based on that.
Yes.
But he didn't guarantee it.
How much money should he knock off the bill? If it's $300 worth of challahs that she's not making the money on, and the bill is $300, how much would she what should he give her off? Yeah. Yes. How much? All of them. Full 300.
Wait. Time out. It costs money to make the challah, so she's not spending the money from the ingredients.
Right, she's not going
to
pay for the ingredients. Okay, good. Okay, so let's say $300 worth of gross, but let's say she would netted $150 worth of labor. Let's say she would net $150 profit. Okay. 50%. Okay. All right. Guys, all right. I just want, before we get into Daphne, we'll have to weigh in again. I the goal of the thing is that what I'm trying to show you, this is a very common thing. Everybody here, has anybody here gone to a tailor, gone to an auto repair place, gone to a repair thing, and there has been an issue, a problem, promise were made, promise were not are not fulfilled. Has it ever happened to you? Of course it has. So there is a halacha concerns stuff with that. That's not something which is not Jewish. That's a very Jewish question.
Is she like over promise selling challahs? Would she give somebody a free challah? Yeah. Like if I made, you know, promise and make 10 halls, but I can only make 6. It's like, sorry, my batches were bigger than they usually are, and I missed out on 4.
Also, if her hollow machine, first of all, she threw it by hand. That's fine. She wouldn't want to do that.
If 50 hollows? 50 hollows? Okay. She could do it, right?
She could grab a lot of fire. Anyway, so she should probably, though, alert her customers.
Well, she has to now.
Well, she should have maybe before, because if her mixer was in the shop, then she shouldn't have assumed that it would be fixed.
Okay.
Stephanie, she's also partially liable.
Hold on, Dad. You don't see other people raise their hand, so I'm just gonna say, yeah. What's your name, by the way?
Nicole.
What's your?
I just want to say that the German didn't say like it's starting today. He said like 2 to 3 days. So. And always these things.
It's a little vague. Longer, like, right. Very good point. It wasn't a death of us. She didn't say, you will get it end of the day Tuesday. Did not make that iron glasses. Still 2 or 3 days. It was already built in vagueness. Okay, I hear that. All right. So I'm gonna read it out. I'm just going to take a piece by piece and I'm going to explain it because I'm going to introduce you to certain concepts that the author, this is Rabbi Meir Orlean's thing. Okay, so he says, is the next, so we're on page 2, whatever. Is appliance repairman liable for the loss of revenue due to the negligence today? Okay. Now he's going to start laying out certain halachic principles. A person who was hired for a time-sensitive job, such as bring flowers for a wedding, but arrived too late, is not entitled to his wages because the employer did not benefit at all, apply the Dayan. Time factor is an integral part of such an employment agreement. That, of course, is a nightmare. You hired a florist and they didn't show up with the flowers. That is a nightmare. Sad. That is just so sad. Obviously, he's not going to see a dollar from that. And of course, CM means Choshen Mishpat. You should know the Shulchan Aruch has 4 books in it. The Code of Jewish Law has 4 books. Orach Chaim is the daily life. Evan Ezer is about marriage and divorce. Yoredei is like Kashrut and conversion. And a lot of different miscellaneous things. And Choshen Mishpat is a section dealing with civil law. So CM is the short for civil law. So this is an open case thing. Now, in our case, though the mixer needs to be fixed regardless of subsequent weeks, even if we were to consider the contractual arrangement as void, Mrs. Horowitz would still have to pay the going rate for the repair as anyone whose poverty is in need of repair, whose properties would need repair. In other words, she got into an obligation. She's got, and he now presents her with a fixed thing. If he repairs it, he has to pay. She is obligated to pay for the repaired mixer. Okay. Nevertheless, the technician might be liable for this week's loss of earnings. Yushalmi, now that's the, there's the Jerusalem, there's two kinds of, there are two kinds of Talmud. There's the Babylonian Talmud and there's the Jerusalem Talmud. Okay. So the Yushalmi, the Jerusalem Talmud teaches that a person who restrains another from earning profit, Mavatel Kiso Shil Chaver, now you're blocking somebody, earning money. This goes to actually Daphne's case of you get into a car accident and make everybody on the highway an hour late for work. According to Jewish law, do you have to pay that person be black? No, not liable for loss, probably because it's considered only a grumma, indirect damage. In other words, you didn't prevent them. You did something that, as a consequence, blocked them from profiting, in this case, coming to work, okay? So there's direct damaging. In other words, I back in my car into your car. That's direct damaging. Versus I do something, and then that causes indirectly damage to occur, okay? Now, therefore, at this point in his going back and forth, does Mrs. Horowitz have a claim on our halal profits against the technician, repairman? Nope, because it's indirect. Okay, because he didn't take the money. He didn't like back up his truck into her 50 challahs and destroy them. That's direct damage. He just didn't get the tool that she needs to make the challahs, and that's an indirect damage. That is a grama. Okay. So right now, in this back and the forth, right now the technician is the repairman is off the hook. Okay, we continue. However, Jushla, there's always a however. Many authorities maintain that an employee who the employer relied upon is liable also for losses, even irrecoverable loss profit caused by his inaction. Ooh, it's a big one. The Gemara, BM, Bava Metzia, that's a classic text, has a lot of business, a lot of the civil law. Okay, we're gonna get there. Teaches that a person who was handed money to buy wine when the prices were low, but neglected to do so, would have to require to pay the lost profit if it was completely in his hand to buy the wine at that price. In other words, he basically says, "Oh, he goes to Israel. I want you to buy the wine, Sheila wine. They're selling it $20 a bottle. They're going for 60. Buy them when you get there." And he says, "Well, I'm going to get to it. I'm going to go to the beach first. I got to go to the hotel. We're going to work on my tan. We're going to go to the Dead Sea." And then shows up, they're back to $60. He says that he's got a nesivos, a commentary based on the Ritva, explains that due to the extra responsibility of the employee, that however others disagree and provide alternate explanations to the Gemara. So basically, at this case, if you're an employee, you have a fiduciary responsible to your employer, and they gave you specific instructions, which you were completely negligent, and then the employer lost money for that, you got to pay the difference. So in the cases, person said, get wine at this very low price. You failed to act. Then the price is high. You still got to buy the wine. That premium, that because of your laziness, negligence, you got to reimburse the guy. Okay? Continue on. On account of this dispute, concluded Rabbi Dayan, the repairman can refuse to repair or return the mixer unless fully paid. However, okay, if he already returned it, Ms. Horowitz can refuse to pay the full amount and deduct her lost profit. And it is proper to compromise. Okay, I'm going to get into that, for example. Verdict. There is a dispute whether an employee is liable for lost revenue due to his negligence. So the muchzak, one in possession, has the upper hand. However, it's proper to compromise. Let me explain what that is. Very important rule in Jewish finance and Jewish business law. I'm going to tell it to you in Hebrew, and I'm going to translate. Hamoti mechavero alav haraya. If you want to extract cash from the other person, you need to have a proof. And if you are, you have to have a proper claim. Since there is a dispute among the halachic authorities that if I'm an employee and I was negligent, do I have to pay for the lost wages or profits that my employer suffered? So the thing is that at this point, so here's the options. He could, the repairman could say, okay, I'm not paying for that. Here's the Bosch mixer. Find somebody else, okay? Or B, if, or you say, I'll give you back, I'm in the middle of the repair, when you pay back. However, if you already returned it, she could say, I'm not paying the full amount, and I could deduct her lost profit because the money's in her possession, and he has to have it, and he doesn't have it, nor they both, the problem here is that they both don't, what do you do when each person has a counterclaim? So the way that halacha sells that is that, where is the cash? Did she pay him? Okay, that's not. Now, he should compromise, as was mentioned before, because there are competing claims, and therefore it's right to come to what they call a pshara. Pshara is a very important word. Compromise, but based upon things. So, but if you want to do in the strict legal law, she could say, I'm not going to pay the full amount, but I'm going to pay the duck, because she has evidence to support her claim, and he has some support to support his claim. So therefore, when you have these sort of that stalemate, then questions, where is the cash? Is it in his pocket or is it her pocket? Okay, so then she could then they can have deduct the money. But as I said, since it's a dispute in the case of negligence, they should do what basically intuitively you would say is that look, Jerry, the repairman, Jerry, I know you mean well, but come on, what can you do for me? you know, that's 50 challahs that I'm not be able to sell because you didn't really, you know, this is not your shining moment here. Can we work on this bill? What can you do for me? Okay. Instead of getting into a legalistic situation. But again, you see already that these things are not so obviously clear case. We're going to go to case number. Davdi, can you read?
Okay. Yes.
All right. The borrowed broomsticks. I'm going to make it a little bigger for you. Everybody can hear you because you're going through the TV. Good.
The log bomber was approaching. The children in the neighborhood had collected wood during the past few days to make a large bonfire in an empty lot. One of them saw a multicolored painted broomstick lying outside his neighbor's garage. He assumed that it was garbage and added to the pile of wood waiting in the lot. The afternoon before Lagwa Omer, Eliezer arranged the wood in a tall teepee-like structure so that the fire could burn high and bright in honor of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. He placed the printed broomstick in the center of the structure to provide support and pile other wooden pieces around it in a teepee fashion. The neighbor happened to stop by and admire the TV structure Eliezer had built. Then he noticed the broomsticks in the middle. "I've been looking for my broomstick since yesterday," the neighbor exclaimed. "I left it outside in my garage and was wondering where it went. Someone must have thought it was garbage," Eliezer apologized. "I'd like it back," said the neighbor. "You're not serious," said Eliezer. "I just spent 4 hours setting up the wood. Taking out the broomstick would make the whole structure collapse." "I want my broomstick back," repeated the neighbor. "I'll pay you for it or buy you a new broomstick," offered Eliezer. "No, the broomstick head has an unusual hole," explained the neighbor. "It's very hard to find a stick that matches it properly." "I'm willing to buy you a fine new broom," offered Eliezer. "No, I like the broom that I have," said the neighbor. "I even decorated the broomstick." Of course, this is what happens in court every day. Just then, Rabbi Dayan happened to walk by. Eliezer approached him and asked, "Can the neighbor demand his broomstick back, or does it suffice if I pay its value?"
Okay, so this guy, as you guys know, who heard, if you go to Israel, and you're there for Lag BaOmer, they have to make a rule this year. Fires. But making fires in honor of Lag BaOmer is a big thing in Israel, okay, and in other places. Okay, that's not the main part. But the guy was, he found an extra broomstick. He thought it was garbage, and he made it, and he made this huge, cheapy, colossal, going to be a mega fire. But the guy wants his broomstick, which is in the center. He pulls it out. It's 4 hours of labor of making this perfectly constructed, massive, fire teepee will come to thing. And he's willing to pay for it. So can the neighbor demand his broomstick back, because it is his, or can I just say, "I paid for it"? What does that do to you? $25, here you go. "Oh, you painted $26. Okay, whatever. All right. So what's the deal? What do you say? Does Eliezer have to, go into the middle of his building of the big thing, yank out his broomstick and hand it back to the guy? Or can he just say, "No, I'm not going to do that because I just invested 4 hours of labor and I'm giving you cash." What do you say? All right, Dan, you get the first call.
I would say judgment in favor of Eliezer. Unless there's something, first of all, the broomstick was left, as trash. So that's on the neighbor. Second of all, unless there's something very special about this broomstick that $26 cannot compensate for, or a similar broomstick, it's unreasonable to ask him to dismantle everything. If he can give him just compensation and he's refusing, then the alternative is to have this kid like dismantle everything to give him back a broomstick for which he could have been justly compensated. The law recognizes a sort of reasonable standard, unless there's something very special or it's like a...
He said it has two features. He decorated the broomstick and has a special hole.
And maybe it's from his grandmother.
Yeah, what if it was like...
He says it has a special hole.
I'm looking at the facts in the record.
Right.
Exactly. I don't know. Did Jackson Pollock decorate this broomstick?
Right. Okay. Good. So. Okay. All right. But okay. So no. But he's saying two things. He has a broom head, has an unusual hole. You know that. In order, you have to have that special. So not every stick fits in. Okay. And even decorated. That's his claim of his uniqueness. The question is that even relevant? The bottom line is, in other words, Judaism, unlike communism, recognizes person property rights. It's yours. Period. You can't, you made a mistake. You thought it wasn't your mine. That was your mistake. I'm terribly sorry. Now, should this guy not be a jerk? Yes, we're not talking about what the guy should do from a moral. We're differentiating between the halachic floor, not the moral ceiling. You understand that? There is a halachic bottom line, and the guy wants to be a tushy. If that is a sophisticated term, and say, no, I need to have my broomstick, and I don't care about your 4 hours of labor, and I don't care about all the kids in the neighborhood going to be sad. I don't care. I'm a broomstick. Have you met such people? Well, they have these. These are 20 feet tall. They're like huge fires. Yeah, because you want to. Right. Anyways, so Daphne argued that it's unreasonable. Eliezer should be able to compensate. Mr. What's the guy's name? Mr. Neighbor. Oh, Mr. AKA Neighbor. Right. Eliezer, who took the broomstick by accident, should be able to pay and not have to think. So, what do you guys say? So raise your thumb if you think that the neighbor can demand that Eliezer give him his broomstick back. Raise your thumb down if you think that the neighbor should receive just compensation, just like Daphne. Daphne, you're a little on the lone side. All right, okay. Okay, all right, so we're going to see how it goes here. All right, here we go. This is the analysis. A person who steals is required to return the item itself while still intact, replied Rai Dayan. He cannot suffice one returning his value without the owner's consent. So, by the way, you should know this. There's a prohibition of theft. I know,
Hold on. Theft is how we would say a conclusion is a legal issue that has not been determined here.
Hold on. Ilya, you raised your hand. I want to bring you into the conversation. Ilya, raise your hand.
I raised my hand because I think he should return the broomstick. If it wasn't one of the next, then doesn't matter. Maybe he did put it somewhere where he shouldn't have. But the fact of the matter is, it is his. He's asking for it back, and he already said no to the money. Okay. So,
right. So most people in the class, to the exception of Daphne, is going with Eliezer has to go into the wood pile, extract the broomstick, even if the entire thing's going to crumble. And his 4 hours of work is going to go to nothing, and hand it back the decorated special broomstick to the neighbor. Everybody's pretty going on that. Okay. So step one, now, halakhically, theft is taking control of an item which does not belong to you. That is the definition of, okay, you could do it. There's intentional theft and there's inadvertent theft. It's still theft. Now, that is a prohibition. Now, you do it by shogeg by accident. Okay, that's a lower level thing. But that automatically generates a mitzvah. And what is a mitzvah? To return the stolen object. That's a special mitzvah. One of the 630 is returning stolen property. Jews record, the Torah says, stealing's going to happen. But there's a mitzvah to that. All right, but you can make amends. And when you do that, you should apologize. Okay, so he says, not only you have to return it, you have to return the item if it's still intact. You can't say, I really like, you know, this is, you know, why shop when you can just steal? So, in fact, I'll pay you for it, but I want the object. Can't do that. Okay, we can continue on. Nevertheless, the Mishnah in Gittin and Gemara and Bava Kamma teaches, Chazal and Stu, this is very important. If a person stole a beam and affixed it in a building, he can pay its value to encourage people to do tshuva. Due to the significant potential loss entailed in dismantling the building, Chazal considered the beam as no longer existing intact so that the thief can't pay its value. Okay? This was a rabbinic legislation. Let me explain it very simply. Let's say a guy stole a beam and he built that beam into his house. So the Chazal wanted to encourage doing tshuva. And if they're going to make the guy take down his entire house, is the guy going to do tshuva? Not likely to say we're going to define that as what? That it's essentially now lost. It's lost in the building structure. And now you have the right to pay the guy the cost of that stolen beam. Okay. All right. So that's,
You can't take the beam out?
You can't. No. So the rabbi says you don't have to destroy the building. You just pay the price of the
But he destroyed a building to take the beam out. Make a new
building.
Like he takes
the beam. No. For example, Home Depot. Right? No, he went to a construction site where there's that nice lumber there. And he did a little chaperine in Yiddish. Chaperine. Okay, it is what it sounds like. Chaperine. He took it. All right, you got it. We keep on learning Yiddish. It's great. However, this enactment was made only when the beam is affixed in a permanent manner to a building attached to the ground or a sukkah during the duration of Sukkot, where it's considered a permanent for that week. Otherwise, the enactment does not apply and the thief is required to return the beam itself. So it has to be, the beam has to be built into the structure. Although the broomstick was placed in the middle of the bonfire and removing or caused the teepee structure to collapse, the obligation to return the stolen broomstick remains. Okay, we continue. Erech Shai, this is a later Achrona, later halachic authority, suggests that whenever the significant additional cost in returning the stolen item itself, this is obviously a relative of Daphne, such as a thief sold to a non-Jew who demands premium for returning it, or the item itself was sent afar, this is included in this enactment. However, this position is questionable. So, in other words, if it's going to require a lot of cost to return it, you may be under that takana, that piece of legislation, which is you just pay the value and not return the object. Perhaps dismantling the log by Omer Bonfire would be considered a significant loss and included in this enactment according to the Erech Shai. However, as mentioned, this position is questionable, and when in doubt about an enactment, we resort to the primary halacha. Furthermore, Erech Shai refers to primarily a financial loss, so presumably, even if you agree that in this case the thief is required to return the broomstick itself. Let me add, concluded Rabbi Dan, that Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai would not consider it an honor to have a bonfire made with stolen wood. You need to be careful whether you take. Verdict. Eliezer must return the broomstick itself, even at a cost of dismantling the teepee bonfire structure, which I may add was the majority of the students in the class. Okay, you guys are on point. All right, it's all right.
File an appeal.
Okay, so we have an appeal from Daphne. She's not happy with that, but she likes the. All right, so you have the. You want to say you want to use the Erech Shai. Okay. Next case, the lost sweatshirt. All right, so Daphne, you get to read the next case again.
Moshe was visiting his friend Hillel for the afternoon, although it was chilly outside, the sun was shining. My winter coat is too heavy for this sunny weather, Moshe said. Do you have an extra sweater? I do, replied Hillel. I bought two a while back, but I barely use the other one. That's funny, replied Moshe. I also have a separate sweatshirt that I barely wear. I use it only when I forget my regular one in yeshiva. The two headed outside and spent the afternoon together. As it grew dark, Moshe looked at his watch. Oh my, it is late, he exclaimed. I've got to get home. The boys returned to Hillel's house. Moshe threw on his coat and rushed home. His mother greeted him. Welcome home, she said. Where is this sweatshirt? Where is that sweatshirt from? I borrowed it from Hillel, Moshe explained. I was in such a rush to get home that I forgot to take it off and leave it there. A week later, Hillel asked for his sweatshirt. Moshe searched for it but could not find it. I'll give you a similar sweatshirt, Moshe offered Hillel. I told you that I also have a spare one. The truth is, I barely use that sweatshirt, replied Hillel. If you lost mine, I'd rather you pay me its value. I'm almost the next size already. I also don't need two sweatshirts, said Moshe. Why should I have to pay cash? For me, it's a waste. You owned an extra sweatshirt anyway. What I had, replied Hillel. Now that sweatshirt's gone, though, and you can't return it, I don't want yours. A sweatshirt is a sweatshirt, said Moshe. It's in the same condition as yours was, maybe even better. It makes no difference, insisted Hillel. Either return my sweatshirt or give me its cash value. This doesn't seem fair to me, countered Moshe. Let's go ask. The two approached Rabbi Dayan and explained the situation. Moshe asked, can Hillel demand that I pay him cash?
Okay. So let's clarify the case over here. Hillel borrowed the sweatshirt. Then he lost the sweatshirt. Hillel lent Moshe the sweatshirt. Moshe lost the sweatshirt. He wants to say, I'm going to give you, I have an extra sweatshirt. I'll give you that sweatshirt. Moshe says, Hillel says, no, I want cash or the original sweatshirt. can Hill demand cash for the lost sweatshirt? Or must he accept the, or must he accept, or and must he, can he, or can he accept the replacement sweatshirt? Raise your hand if Hill can demand cash. He said either you return the original sweatshirt, which obviously he has to do, or cash. Okay, everybody going? Okay, by the way, those who can't see, I'm just going to get a quick. Right hand. Who thinks you can get cash? Okay, nearly everybody's raising their hand for the cash. All right. People in Zoom land, what do you guys say? Ilya, can Hill demand that he get cash for the lost sweatshirt and not accept his Moshe's extra sweatshirt?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
Suzanne. Cash.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. Cash. Dassey, what says you?
Yo, so stupid. You're losing a friend over what? Over nonsense. Okay, how much could it? And also, you won't get the retail value of your sweatshirt. You'll get the value of buying a sweatshirt at Housing Works. So what? You lost a friend for $20? I'd say give Hillel his $20, shalom al Yisrael, and goodbye forever.
Okay, so first, okay, what Daphne is saying right now, truth is, Daphne is bringing up an excellent point. Many times people have financial disputes, and it has caused, among families and friends, untold personal damage. The arguments are over stupid things like this, and then they're not going to talk to each other. I'm sure every family that you are a part of has two members in it who are currently not talking to each other. True or not true? We got a true on that. We got a name.
It's a good thing
that
we have Yom Kippur.
Right. Okay. But Yom Kippur does not atone for sins or offenses done to another person if you do not get that. If you do not ask for a reconciliation, if people are not talking, they got to work it out. That's another mitzvah. So, in the ethos of what you should not be an idiot and get on a fight for a $20 sweatshirt or $30 sweatshirt, you should be a little wise. But the fact is that Hillel's now locked in a very legalistic mentality. You lost my sweatshirt, pay me the money. Okay? That's where he's at. Okay, so, but halacha is a floor, not a ceiling. So he has a claim. Moshe borrowed his sweatshirt. He lost the sweatshirt. He owes him. He either return the sweatshirt or he's got to do something. And the fact that he wants to take something out of his closet, apparently impressed none of you. Dad, ask a question.
Let's say I borrow your sweatshirt.
Nice.
And I lose it.
Ooh.
And then I say, I will give you a sweatshirt, and it's a giant sweatshirt. And he's an Eagles fan. See, this is where I don't know.
Well, that's what they basically offer. He's offering a better, slightly better sweatshirt.
To play. It's fine. It's better. Okay. I'm not wearing an Eagles
All right. Okay, guys, they're already 9:12. I do not want to keep you late. So, all right. I want to finish off. We're at the last case, the verdict. Let's go for it. When a guardian or shoel borrower is liable for an entrusted item, he's liable for its value. He's not required to replace items. So if you're a borrower, this is Moshe, borrowed a sweatshirt, you are required to replace it if you lose it. The Shah compares to a guardian who is liable to one who damages, since the Gemara, Babakama, includes guardians in the framework of Avos Nezikin, the four categories of damages. The Torah requires that one who damages to pay meta, which is Mishnah explains to me, when paying with real estate, he must pay with a higher grade. Okay, so there's now. Elsewhere, the Gemara says she's an immovable item are all considered meta, the better option, since they can all be sold readily here or there and converted to cash, unlike real estate, which is fixed in its location. Now, regarding repayment of a loan, Shulchan Aruch rules that if a debtor has money, he cannot repay with movable items or real estate unless the lender agrees. Just because the debtor receives money is committed to return in kind. In other words, if I borrow money, I get, I borrowed $1,000. Here's $1,000 computer still in the original box. Cannot do that. You borrow the cash, pay back in cash. Okay. Conversely, you're a guardian of an object. You have to return the original item. Okay. Or now However, regarding the liability of damages or as a garden, the law does not apply. Therefore, most Rishonim write that an owner cannot specifically demand cash payment. His primary right is to collect the value of the loss from the meita, from the better property. And all the movable items are considered meita. Thus, the Shulchan Aruch rule. Meita means the better quality item in that class. So in the game, we're going to talk about sweatshirts. If he has a better sweatshirt, he has to give him the better sweatshirt. Hold on, let me just finish off and I'll explain all and put it all together. Thus, the Shulchan Aruch rules that even if one who damages has cash, he can pay with movable objects. They should be evaluated according to their worth being sold locally and immediately. You cannot find a distinction between the shoal and other gardens in the regard requires the shoal. Thus, Moshe can fulfill his liability with a replacement of a sweatshirt of equal value. Everybody got it wrong. Verdict. The owner of the entrusted or lent item that was lost cannot demand cash payment, and the guardian or shoal can fulfill his liability with movable items of equivalent value and certainly a replacement item.
How is it consistent with the broomstick case?
Because he didn't borrow the broomstick. He stole it.
He did not say, okay.
He stole it. Okay. He stole it. He didn't borrow it. He didn't say, hi, Mr. Neighbor, can I borrow yours? No, he stole it. Albeit inadvertently, but it's still a theft. And therefore, notice the distinction. With theft, you got to return the same object.
With your garbage. You discarded it.
He put it in front of his house. Very important. In front of his house. It was not discarded. By the way, it was on his property. If it was in the dumpster, he'd have no claim. He'd have no claim. That is the final
part. Not everyone in that neighborhood puts their trash in front of their house. Okay. This is a... Okay. I agree with you, Gordon.
Okay. Hold on. All right. Shh. What's that? All right. We're at 9:15. We're at the last minute here. Okay. My goal here is I want to accomplish one thing. What I think we accomplished, which is that these are common cases. Stuff happens. So what's that? Again, that was Daffy's point, and I agree with a larger point. You do not want to be legalistically, what they call in Hebrew, that's a nice phrase, rush katan, small-minded. Because you are going to win the battle, you are going to lose the war. In this case, you're going to lose the relationship. But again, halacha has to go with what is the bottom line? So the halacha differentiates. Buy stolen property, you got to return the stolen item. Unless it was a piece of construction, which is actually affixed into your house, is considered lost, and then you have the right and obligation to return the financial value. Buy, if you are a guardian, you borrowed an item of clothing, it got lost or destroyed, you do not have to pay the cash value. You can, but you can replace it with an equal or better item. Equal replacement value of the sweatshirt. The Moshe has a slightly better sweatshirt. He can have, says Hillel, Shulchan Aruch says, I borrowed this sweatshirt. I lost the sweatshirt. Shulchan Aruch says, I can give you the replacement value of an item, movable property. Okay, so my point being is that the main point I want to walk away is that I have a halakha shad. I get asked questions every day. Now, most of my questions could be the answer to this, Rabbi, can I eat this? That's basically my question, okay? Or this happened in the kitchen, can I now eat this? Or I did this, can I fix, what can we do about the pots and pans and this and that? And, okay. And those are important questions. But I think it would be helpful to you to, now that you're becoming sensitized, to see financial issues in the same light of thing. What would be the luckier now? The truth is, I happen to enjoy it because I'm working on this. This is my next area of a luck I'm trying to get a handle on. I'm not there yet. Big project. But, and I have Dayanim, who I can consult because I'm not a Dayan yet. So it's something that we're, you know, people ask questions about Shabbos observant, great. People ask questions about Yom Tov observant, great. Kashrut, great. Tefillah, great. All, you know, good. But I want to share that the Ten Commandments has two sides between you and God, which are we'll call them the ritualistic mitzvahs, and between your fellow person and how we treat people in our dealings. And stuff's going to happen. Property is going to get lost. Damages are going to happen. Mistakes are going to be made. Investments are going to be lost. There's going to be floods. There's going to be negligence. This all happens. It's all part of life. You cannot get around that. That's called life. What's my response? What's my responsibility on the baseline halakha level, the minimalistic, that I'm no longer a barbarian. I'm a lawful person who responds appropriately to the rights of another person, Jew or non-Jew alike. And then there's different gradations. We'll be with all what they call lifnei mishur hadin, going beyond the letter of the law. How can I be an exceptional person where I'm actually giving up some of my rights to ensure that the relationship and that my value in the person is maintained?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes. Matt?
So I actually had the opportunity to ask Rabbi Penny a situation that happened to me. I'm not sure if you recall this or not.
I do remember.
But I hosted a Shabbat dinner for like 10 people and spent a lot of time, a lot of money, like trying to make it a perfect experience for everybody. Made all the food myself. And this one person was running late and they said, "Hey, I don't want to carry this muksa on Shabbat. Can I leave it at your house?" And like, I was just like swarmed with like getting the last touches on the meal and getting myself ready for Shabbat. But I said, sure. But I didn't ask what she was leaving. I didn't ask where she put it. Later that night, everybody left. That person says, I need to go and get something out of my bag. I also have a friend that's sleeping over. The person that's sleeping over notices, you know, where they left the bag and what they put it, or that they took something out of it. And that they said that this is my stuff, not that stuff. And they went on their way. And then the next day they come over for lunch. And they say, "Where's my bag?"
What was in the bag, Matt? What kind of bag? What kind
of bag? It's a broomstick, a decorated broomstick.
Not decorated. Go on.
Yeah. So.
What was in the bag?
Yeah. So I said, "Oh man, what type of bag was it?" She goes, "It was a paper Trader Joe's bag." And I said, "Oh my gosh, the person that was staying with me on their way out to shul, they accidentally thought it was recyclables because there was bottles in it, supposedly, and they put it in the recycling bin 2 hours ago. And they got really upset."
What else was in the Trader Joe's bag?
So then I said, "Why are you so upset? What was in it?" And they go, "My brand new iPhone, a wallet with like $100 in it, a passport, a nice jacket."
This person is a genius in a Trader Joe's bag. That's a universal recycling bag in New York City. Matt Davis, yeah. Not liable. Case is
yeah. So, so I was like, we're going to call security. We're going to see, you know, maybe one of my neighbors saw it in the bin and they pulled it out because they noticed it was valuables. My security camera showed that a homeless person came and was going through recycling within that 2 hour period and took it, and there was nothing that we could do. So I went back to her, asked her what she wanted. She was like, "Look, you know, like I do feel like I owe some responsibility here because, you know, she felt like she was somewhat responsible, but she also felt like the person who threw it away was responsible and the place, and that I was also responsible because I said I would watch it." And, you know, I was like, you know, had I known that you had $1,500 worth of, I said, "How much, what do you value it at?" She's like,
Okay, let him finish the case. Go on.
Yeah. So I was like, wow.
That format.
I know that had you told me I was watching $1,500 worth of stuff, I would have put it in the safest place in my house. You know, I had 10 people, some of the people I've never met before, and if the stuff's just laying by the door, somebody could have even taken it for all I know. Like, I don't know exactly everybody that's here. There's so much things that could, and I started thinking about things that maybe my friend might have taken. Like, I started thinking really bad things. Maybe they took it. Maybe they took all their stuff out, and there was nothing in there. My friend thought it was a paper bag. Like, I was thinking, like, these horrible things about my friend, and, like, at the end of the day, like, I just had to give everybody, you know, the benefit of the doubt that what she said is true, what my friend said it was true. And so then I was like, "What do you recommend?" She said, "Everybody should take a third. I'll take over 500. You guys take over the next 1,000. And then I was like,
I don't know if I really feel comfortable giving you $1,000, but what we'll both do is we'll each give you $200. So me and my friend, we both give $200. And then I said that I'm going to consult some other people. One of the people I consulted is Rabbi Penny. Rabbi Penny, you know, gave me his idea. He said that also, you know, but most importantly, the friendship, you know, like you, there's the right and wrong, but there's also the friendship. And I asked my friend, I was like, hey, you know, we both gave $200. Do you want to give any more? He said, absolutely not. So that meant that I would have to give another $600 to make her feel happy. So total me, 800, my friend, 200. And I was, and my friend was like, Matt, you're not responsible. Go to the basin. And, you know, I'd never been to the basin before, my friend was saying, and I would love to have the opportunity to go to the basin to hear how, see how it works and hear what they have to say and how they come to their conclusion. And I, you know, I was talking to some other people and they're like, Matt, the basin has a lot more important things to do, you know, like no. don't waste their time, you know? And I was like, okay with it. I knew that she was distraught because she was like without her phone. And then I talked to my brother, who's a personal injury attorney, and he empathizes with the victim. And he's like, Matt, how much, you know, great phone, like all the pictures on your phone, you know, like, can you imagine losing those? Because yeah, my brother also just had a baby. So like, you know, like he values those pictures. And anyways,
what happened?
So I was reading Rabbi Wild's book right before Rosh Hashanah. And this one thing that he mentioned, he said that a farmer, when he's, you know, taking care of his crops and he like takes the crops out of the field and he leaves some behind, he can't go back for those crops. He has to give those to the poor. And even though he didn't intend to do the mitzvah, he still got credit for the mitzvah. And I was going into Rosh Hashanah. The friendship was important for me. And I was like, you know what? Friendship's important to me. And I know that even though I didn't intend to do this mitzvah, I'm going to get credit for doing the mitzvah. And so I ended up giving her another $600. So I gave her a total of $800. And now, whenever I tell this story, I get to look like the good guy.
This person. I have a question, Rabbi Penny. This person that left $1,500 worth of valuables in a Trader Joe's bag and put Matt in this terrible situation.
Yeah.
I don't know if I would want to be friends with that person either. I mean, there's some.
We're gonna leave that for Matt to assess the relationship. But I would just suggest is that there is a small claims court based in that deals with these kind of smaller cases up in Muncie, and you can work it because you can't. By the way, here's a halacha. You cannot adjudicate a financial dispute, hearing only one side of the story. Very important. In other words, you can ask a rabbi about a kosher question and then he can answer it quickly. But if it's unclear who's negligent and how much negligent, both parties have to give their case in front of the other person to the dayan. You could choose to have one rabbi be your dayan. We can say like, we're going to arbitrate like, we're gonna pick this rabbi who's in, and we're gonna, but they have to hear both sides of the story in front of both people. So it can't be like, or you can ask rabbis about the ritual laws individually, but financial laws, which is a question about negligence and where did they put it and how obvious was it, and they have to hear both sides of the story. So
I have a question, Rabbi Penny, real quick. So if it's a question, let's say you know before going. If it's a question of violating this law of carrying something prohibited on Shabbos or putting Matt Davis in a situation where he's going to be financially liable and think the worst of his friends, I think you should just carry the stuff. I think that's the lesser evil.
Well, but that was not an obvious. They were unaware about the fact that nobody knew.
Trader Joe's bags in New York City won't be confused as recycling.
Okay, all right.
Unaware. I mean, did they just get here?
So I wasn't there, but the key point is that what level of negligence that is a very that material question is a question that the dying would have to ask Matt and the person, where was it? All these different questions. And you're right. So it could be that
white people don't host.
By the way, it could very well be that Matt could have been off the altogether because as you were, you know, they might side with you, Daphne, but basically that is, you know, are completely negligent. If you put something valuables in essentially in a garbage bag, and the garbage bag gets thrown out after a busy Friday night dinner in the Upper West Side, he could be exempt. That's true. That is a legit possibility. Okay, but that was the Shire. That's what the dying would have to hear both sides. But it's better to come with it with the call up Shire. Work out peaceably. Come to a deal. Now, if you're not happy with a deal, you can always bring it to base time. All right, guys, we're over time. Great topic. All right, guys, all the best.
Thank you for everything. Very good class.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
All right, hold on.